Although I always say those who want to have seats or want to have the spot by the wall where they can lean back, you have to get there early to get the spots by the wall. Okay, everybody's in now. Great. Okay, for this evening's talk, I'm going to talk about how to deal with conflict and arguments and all that sort of stuff, because it's so unpleasant that when we, live with our husband or wife, with our family, with our fellow monks, or just people we meet, that why we have so many arguments and conflicts in life, and to see what Buddhism has to say about that, to try and help solve the differences of opinion which we have in our community. And perhaps the main reason why this is in the front of my mind this evening is just a nice piece of news for you, is that before coming here today, I went to the cathedral, St. George's Cathedral, to have a photo opportunity with the dean, because Sunday week I'm giving the sermon there. And so the newspapers were there because apparently this is the first time in 2,000 years that a Buddhist monk has given a sermon on a Sunday afternoon in church. And I thought, I'm very proud of the fact that I'm doing this. And I'm very humbled and very praising of the dean, and I suppose the archbishop must be in on this as well, for actually letting a Buddhist monk give a sermon, sort of in one of the main services of the week in the cathedral. And just thinking that what a wonderful thing it is actually to show that gestures of harmony and friendship towards each other. I've often said that if people of religion can't show the way to living in peace and harmony together, then what hope is there in the world, and what a bunch of hypocrites we are. But it's not easy to put aside one's differences of opinions. And also, why do we have such differences of opinions in the first place? Why is it that everyone in this room probably has a different idea about all sorts of things? We can never really agree on each other. Why is that, as human beings? Why can't everyone see the truth and be like me? That actually fascinated me for many years. And when you hear from these great teachers of the forest tradition, it's so often that they spend their times, sitting here, just dealing with people's arguments. And one of the stories which always fascinated me from the Buddhist repertoire of wise sayings was a story from the Zen tradition. And it was a story of these two monks who were arguing about whether reincarnation was an important part of Buddhism or not, or whether you can actually understand Buddhism in this very life, right here and now. Do you have to really believe in reincarnation to be a Buddhist? And one of them said, yes, you do, because it's in the text, the Buddha said this, and basically Buddhism doesn't make sense unless you believe in reincarnation. The other monk said, no, you don't need to believe in reincarnation, because how do you know what's happened? What's going to happen when you die? You haven't died yet. Who knows what's going to happen? The future is uncertain. So how do you know there's such a thing as reincarnation or rebirth? It's not essential. All you need to do is just to be mindful, to be wise, have a peaceful mind. That's enough. So there's this big argument. So one of the monks went to see the abbot, this wise old monk. And he went into the abbot's office and he said, venerable, sort of, isn't it true? The Buddha taught reincarnation, and it's a central part of Buddhism, and you have to be a Buddhist, you have to believe in reincarnation to be a Buddhist. And the abbot listened to what this monk was saying and said, actually, yeah, no, you're right. It's true. And so this monk went out smirking to the other monk, see, the abbot said I was right and you're wrong. And the other monk said, he can't have said that. And so he went into the abbot's office and said, look, so didn't the Buddha said that the Dhamma is in this moment, it's here and now, the present moment, just like I was talking in the beginning of this meditation, just the present moment, that's all you have. So this rebirth, reincarnation, it's just going on into the future. It's not essential, it's not necessary. And the abbot listened and said, you're right. Yeah, you're right. And so the second monk went out to the first monk and said, see, the abbot said I was right. He couldn't have said that, because he said I was right. No, he didn't. He said I was right. So they went in together. And then the first man said, "You said I was right." And the second man said, "But you said I was right. We can't both be right." And the abbot thought about it and said, "Yeah, you're right." Now, the meaning of that story is not just a joke. The meaning of that story, because the reason why people laugh is because you can empathize with that. Because a lot of the times it's when we listen to one side of the story, then of course we say, "Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That's right." And then when we listen to the other side of the story, we say, "Yeah, that's right." Isn't it the case that our views, our ideas, our thoughts, our beliefs all come from because we just listen to one side of the story? The trouble is that one side of the story, we say, "That's right and that's truth." This is where arguments come from. Not only is it just one side of the story, but a lot of the times that side of the story, you're not really pretty accurate. You make lots of assumptions anyway about what happened. That's one of the problems with memory. A lot of arguments and conflicts happen about who did what and when and how, or more like who didn't do that. And this is another fascinating part of the mind, which is a monk I've been contemplating for many years. Actually, what is memory? And why is it that memory is uncertain? Because I've been having a running argument with my brother about which one of us had German measles when we were young. I'm absolutely certain it was me. I can remember it, taking the time off school and going back to school and being told by the teacher, "No, that you can't come back yet," because I think you had to stay away for 1 week or something. But I felt fit and I liked school. I wanted to go back. Actually, I didn't like school. I liked the playtime, playing soccer with my mates. But anyway, I want to get back to school. So the teacher actually sent me home again. "No, you can't come yet." I really remember that, but my brother is absolutely sure it was him who had German measles. So I remember some time ago asking my mother, I said, "I can't remember. I know that one of you did, not the other, but I can't remember which one." But it really fascinated me why it was that one of us was absolutely, only one of us had that German measles. We're absolutely sure that I was absolutely sure it was me. He was absolutely sure it was him. And none of us lie. My brother's a very honest man, and I'm pretty honest as a monk. And a long time ago, I started looking at what memory actually is. And what most people's memory is, it's very similar to that game you may have played when you were kids called Chinese Whispers. When you stand in a line with all the other children, and the teacher whispers something into the first child's ear. And the first child has to whisper it into the second child, will go to the third child, the fourth child, all the way down the line, maybe 30 children. And at the end of the line, the last child says what the message was. And it's always very different than the first message. I think you've heard me say here before that one of the classic cases of that which has happened during the First World War, when the order came from the general to send reinforcements, we're going to advance. And by the time it got to the troops at the front line or the troops in the barracks somewhere, it got to send 3 and 4 pence, the old British money. 3 and 4 pence, we're going to a dance. So this is actually what happens. Now, but it's also, you can see there's a bit of wishful thinking in there because they didn't really want to fight. They really wanted to go and play. But that is how memory works. You know, what we remember is not the event itself. We remember the last time we remembered it. So really, we remember the memory of 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 the memory, and so on, many, many times, right to the event. And each time, we can change it just a tiny bit, a lot of times through wishful thinking. Really, we want to remember what we want it to have been like, not really what it was like. So little by little, we actually change memory. That's why I've seen that memory is not reliable. And so, when we ask somebody who said what, and how many arguments at home about that? Who did what and who said what? You promised you'd take me to the Buddhist Society tonight. No, I didn't. Yes, you did. No, you didn't. Yes, you did. The point is, you can actually say, well, you know, memory's uncertain. I'm not sure if I remember correctly. Maybe you don't remember correctly either. Wouldn't it be a wonderful thing if we remembered that? Then there would be no arguments anymore. Because that story about those two monks and the third monk, the teacher, yeah, everyone was right. You can say different things and both are right. Because it's right from your perspective. You're being truthful, being honest, that what you remember to what you've experienced. Because a lot of times that when it's something close to our experience, when we really think it's right, that's when we get into an argument. And how do you know it's right and not right? How much of what we say is right is based on memory and so many assumptions? Even what a person said to you. Sometimes I've asked people after I've given a talk. You know, people come here every Friday night afterwards when we're back in the reception area. What did I talk about this evening? Don't really know. What did you talk about? Even what you just talked about, a lot of people don't remember. They only remember the jokes. But sometimes you remember the themes, what's important to you, but you don't remember what's not important to you. And this is why that when you have an argument or a disagreement with somebody, you look upon whether your idea and view is based upon facts. Facts. What are facts anyway? What can you actually base facts on? Certainly not your memory. And I think I mentioned here before I went to Malaysia, there was a professor who was just retiring in the US, and in his clearing through some of his documents, he found out that some 34 years earlier, he'd done a statistical survey on this group of children's circumstances at home. Little things, whether they love their mother or their father most, or you know, whether their parents understood them, or whether they felt happy at home. Even little things, whether your parents actually punished you physically. And he had all this information from about 150 students, 150 like 14-year-olds I think they were. And this was about 34 years ago. And so he decided to see how many of those students he could trace and ask them the very same questions and see if their memory of their childhood corresponded to what they'd actually written 34 years previously. And the wonderful thing about that study was just how much lack of correspondence there was. I think he managed to find about 90 of those 150 children, asking them the same questions. Were you happy at home? So many of the children who said yes, they were happy at home, now 34 years on, said they had a terrible childhood. Many of the children who said at the time their parents used corporal punishment now said no, they didn't. Simple facts were actually changed in the space of 34 years. It just showed how much we cannot rely on our memory. And police know that whenever they investigate, say, a traffic accident, and they take witness statements, they're amazed that people actually saw the accident and they have different accounts of what happened. Even just a few minutes ago, the memory is unreliable. So when we understand that, at least we won't argue on memory of who did what, when. We can accept the fact that even though I'm absolutely sure it was me, and I said that, and I did that, that surety is uncertain. So basically, I don't know what I did. I don't even know what I talked about last week. What did I talk about last week? My memory of it and your memory of it may be something quite different. So that way we can tolerate those differences in memory. We don't need to make it a conflict and an argument. It's the first example. It's not factual what we remember. Also, what we see, is that really factual? Now, I saw him coming there today. I almost got into trouble a few years ago. As a monk, I have very strict rules I have to keep. For example, as a monk, because I'm celibate and got to be proved to be celibate, I can't be alone with a woman. The same with the nuns, they cannot be alone with a man. Because, people might talk, and they see you going around with that woman all the time. Yap, yap, yap. My father used to, this was years ago, even before I had any idea I was going to be a monk, he used to tell this joke: what fun does a monk have? Answer: none. So even then, you've got to be very careful because this is what people expect. So you've got to be very careful, being very strict. And so one day, we had a visiting nun here, one of the first nuns who actually came to visit Perth. And she wore dark brown, like Sister Ajahn Mayama. She wears a darker brown, but still got the bald head. So this one day, this nun was visiting, and after she finished the meal on a Saturday, she went in the car with one of the other ladies to be shown around Perth. And one of the Thai ladies, who'd been bringing the Dana, she came outside and she saw this brown-robed, bald-headed person sitting in a car next to a woman going out for a drive. And straight away she says, "Ajahn Brahm! Ajahn Brahm! He's going out with a lady." And I would have been in big trouble if I hadn't have come out of the hall that moment. "Ajahn Brahm! Oh, that's Ajahn Brahm." Because it would have been so difficult for me to actually have said it wasn't me. Because she said, "I saw you." And she would have absolutely convinced that was Ajahn Brahm. Like, I saw it with my own eyes. I'm not blind. I saw him in a car. And it shows you just, I was very fortunate at that time. It shows you how it is so easy to get into arguments, even for what you see, even for what you hear. You can't take that to be fact. Not only that, but whatever we experience, we always give a spin on because we see what we're looking for and we hear what we want to hear. So sometimes some of the monks come up to me and they keep asking me for special sort of special things. So they want to go overseas, go and want to visit Thailand. And they come up to me and say, "Can I visit, go to Thailand?" I say, "No, you can't go to Thailand." "Can I go to Thailand?" "No, you can't go to Thailand." "Can I go?" "No, you can't go to Thailand." Many, many times I say no. But once I say, "Well, I don't really care." "Oh, thank you." And then they say, "I can go to Thailand." Just once is all they're looking for. And they keep on asking, asking, asking. Sure enough, somebody's going to say yes sooner or later if you keep badgering them. And this is what happens. We're asking questions because we want to hear something. We want to hear, and that's all we hear. Everything else which is said, we don't hear. There's a filtering mechanism which goes on in the mind. That's a lot of times where arguments come from. Because we see what we want to see. We hear what we want to hear. And the other person hears what they want to hear and see what they want to see, feel what they want to feel. And because our wants are different, our realities different, and there is a seed of conflict. So to overcome that conflict, when we understand that what I'm thinking, what I'm saying isn't factual, and I'm not right, just because I've seen that, because I know that, because I remember that, does not mean it is right. It doesn't mean you're wrong either. There's something between being right and wrong. It's just as I've conceived it, as I view it. And it doesn't mean that because I conceive it this way, because I view it this way, that it must be absolute right and everyone else is wrong. That's why the Buddha said again and again that anybody who says that all this is right and everything else is wrong is asking for conflict and trouble. And it's wonderful, it's an act of humility and great wisdom to not hold for your ideas like a fundamentalist terrorist in the world. You know that from fundamentalism we have terrorism? And that's in the family, isn't it? We've got terrorist husbands, we've got terrorist wives. Because they fundamentally, they hold on to an idea, they hold on to a view, this is truth, and everything else is wrong. Now, that happened to me some years ago. When I was a second monk, and Ajahn Jocko was the abbot, we were building our main hall in Bodhinyana Monastery. Many of you have seen that hall. That was Ajahn Jocko's idea. It wasn't my idea. I wanted to build something much more simple, much more different. And I got angry at Ajahn Jocko. And I said, look, this is a stupid idea. You shouldn't build it this way. We had an argument. Even monks argue now and again. But I think we were having an argument for about a week. But then I came to my senses. It was my mistake. I went to his hut and I asked forgiveness from him. This is what we do as monks. It's very beautiful to have this ceremony of asking forgiveness, especially after you've had an argument. Don't just say sorry, because sorry is not enough. You've got to make a ceremony out of it. So as monks, we get a tray of flowers, candles and incense. These days, because I suffer from hay fever, at the monastery they've got these plastic flowers which they keep especially just for me. There's one of the monks off this morning because he's going to New Zealand. And you go up there and you say, you know, for whatever I've done by body, speech and mind, intentional or unintentional, if I even didn't mean it, look, I really ask your forgiveness for this. It's one of the most beautiful ceremonies of Buddhism. This is actually what I did at this occasion, because I realized I had an argument and it didn't matter who was right and who was wrong. I realized from what I still think I was right. But that's only coming from me. It doesn't mean I'm ultimately right. And he thought he was right, and that's his right as well, to feel he's right. But I thought the best thing to do, and the one thing I was very proud of, I went and asked forgiveness of him and said, look, I'm very sorry to have an argument with you, but please, I ask a favor from you. And I asked this favor from him. I said, look, I want to have the hall built your way, but please let me be the builder. And I want to actually build this hall, which I don't agree with. And you know how, those of you who know me for a while, know how hard I work as a builder. That main hall in Bodhinyana Monastery, if you go to the shrine, that's got my name on as a builder. And I did a lot of work on that, and I put my heart into that. I thought that's a wonderful way of actually learning about harmony. Not just to say, I don't agree with that, but if you want to do it, you just go and do it. Go on, I'm not going to get involved in this at all. I'm not going to sulk and be... And just, but I actually built that, and I put all my effort into that. I'm very proud of that. I thought it was a marvelous thing to do, because it was understanding just how to overcome conflict. So if you have an argument with somebody, instead of just, you know, saying I'm right, you're wrong, how about saying, well, you know, I disagree with you, but I'm going to go your way. Not only am I going to go your way, but I'm going to give my heart and all my energy into helping your way succeed. There's a certain like nobility in that, and it certainly sort of made us great friends. The same as one of the early stories when I was a young monk, and these first monks went to the West. They went to England first of all, a long time before they came to Australia. And this one time, that it was very difficult in those days because, you know, the monks, you know, it was almost like a culture shock. You weren't getting the same support you got in Asia. It was very difficult being the first few years as a monk in the West. And because of one thing or another, these two monks were having an argument in the grounds of this monastery in Chithurst in England. And it was a very fierce argument. And both of these characters were very tough guys. One was an ex-Vietnam Marine, a war veteran. He was a Marine. He volunteered to go into the U.S. Marines so he could go and fight and kill people. He got shot in the back of the head while he was in Vietnam, managed to survive, And we say that knocked a lot of sense into him. And he eventually became a Buddhist monk. So, but he was tough. And the other guy was, he was born as a Jew. He became a Buddhist monk. He was a millionaire real estate from Chicago. He was a second monk. And they're having an argument, nose to nose, shouting at each other, cursing each other, even though they were monks. And the other monks were just too afraid to actually to intervene and just wondering what would happen. They thought it'd be a fight or a fist fight, even monks. But eventually what happened was it was the Vietnam veteran, the Marine, the guy who got shot in the back of the head in Vietnam, suddenly came to his senses. He was inspired by Dhamma, what he'd heard before. And now he put into practice. He got down on the ground in the middle of the argument and bowed to the other monk, the Chicago real estate millionaire, and said, "I'm sorry." And at that, the other monk just burst into tears. And the two of them afterwards walked away arm in arm, friends. Brilliant. In the middle of an argument, about to have a fight, someone says, and they really mean it, doing a gesture, bowing down and says, "Sorry." Because it came from his heart, it reached the other person's heart and went far beyond the pettiness of the argument. And what are we arguing about anyway? Is it really important what we argue about? And why it is that those arguments, "I'm absolutely right," why they cause so much suffering in our lives? In the time of the Buddha, there was this famous occasion when two of these kingdoms were going to go to war over the irrigation waters from a river which divided their lands. Because there was a drought and both parties needed that water for their crops. And so the Buddha came to them and said, "What's more important? What's more valuable, blood or water?" They said, "Blood is obviously much more valuable than water. But when, why are you going to waste so much blood by killing each other over this water?" They came to their senses. Blood is much more important than water. So they stopped their fighting. What's more important, being right and being wrong, or living in harmony together at peace? What's it like when you have arguments? You lose your friends, you break up your marriages, your relationships, and you feel afterwards, most people, when this happens to you, they feel, "What a mistake that was. What a stupid person I was to stop this happiness, this friendship, this love over stupid little argument." The thing is, it usually goes too far. We can't stop it anymore. We should have at least some mindfulness to stop it earlier. Stop thinking you're right. You know the old story, which I think many of you hear, but it fits in here for those of you who haven't, about Ajahn Chah's story about the chicken and the duck. The brilliant story which he used to tell all the time, because a lot of times people would come and see him because they have marital problems. That's why people come and see me as well, to try and solve their marriage problems. And I'm a monk. What do I know about marriage? Still, they come. I must be doing something right because they still keep coming. And he told this story, which those of you who are married know this is what married life is about. Two couple, a couple, man and woman, just only married a short time, walking in a forest in the afternoon or in the evening, just for some recreation, having a nice time together. And they heard this sound, quack quack, quack quack. Straight away, the man said, "Ah, dear, listen to that chicken." You know what men are like. And so I said, "Darling, that's not a chicken, that's a duck." And then very firmly he said, "No, wife, that is a chicken." And it went quack quack again, "There is a chicken." And with great patience, the wife said, Listen, husband dear, chickens go cock-a-doodle-doo. Ducks go quack-quack. That wing quack-quack. Therefore, that must be a duck. And the husband said, no, it's not. It's a chicken, raising his voice. And the wife raised her voice. It's not. It's a duck. They went quack-quack again. There, it's a duck. And he said, no, it's a chicken, raising his voice even louder and looking very angry at his wife. And his wife, who was the wise one, thought for a few moments and said, oh, I'm sorry, I think you're right. It is a chicken. It went quack, quack again. What a wise woman that was. Because isn't it true that so many of the arguments you have with your loved ones are all about chicken and duck stuff, stupid things, which aren't really important anyway, but just because you have to be right, you say, it's a chicken, no, it's a duck. How many divorces happen over chickens and ducks? Heaps of them. And as I say to people afterwards, who knows anyway? It could have been a chicken impersonating a duck. Because the point is, again, we always think we are right. It's true. We always think that chickens go quack. No, chickens go quack, quack. Well, my chickens do. There might be some sort of genetically modified chicken. I don't know. Which goes quack, quack. But you don't know these days, do you? So because of that, we always think we're right. How many times have you been wrong? When you really thought you were absolutely right and you found out you were wrong? How many times? I've done that many times. I'll put my hand up. So why is it that we're willing to have an argument with our loved ones? We're willing to have all that suffering and all that pain of conflict just to prove we're right? And one of the things is because in our life, we got this conditioning that we have to be right. You know, you don't have to be right. It's okay to be wrong. It's okay to make mistakes in life. You don't always have to be an expert and get 10 out of 10. You can make mistakes and you can be wrong. It's marvelous when you see that and you ask a teacher and then you prove a teacher wrong because you say, the Buddha didn't say that, you know, and you get the text out. And he says, oh yeah, yes, you're right, I was wrong. That shows a great deal of wisdom and humility and a great deal of what you might say, understanding of truth. It's okay to be wrong in life. Because what that means is that you don't always have to defend your rightness to the point of upsetting all the people you like and live with and love and care for. The point of that woman's wisdom in that chicken and duck story was a woman realized what was more valuable was the harmony between the two of them. They had to live together. They were husband and wife. They had to make it work, at least that evening. It was much better to have the two of them having a nice walk in the evening together and going home and not having this argument together. And you know what it's like when you have arguments together, you know, you don't know what to do next and you feel really rotten and you've got to live with that person at least for a few days until you can see a lawyer anyway. So it's hell having arguments. And basically, this world is getting too small to have arguments and to have conflicts and to have fights. One of the reasons I was inspired by that, the dean, was it John Roberts, I think, of St. George's Cathedral, it was a wonderful gesture of like harmony. Okay, now I disagree with, you know, on many things with the Christians, especially all chickens and ducks. It's not so important whether God created the universe or someone else. Or that's not important, is it? What really is important is the friendship and harmony and the love and the care and the working together which we can do in our society. And anyway, when it gets to sort of ultimate truth, you know, just I was meditating just before here, When you get to real ultimate, it's that silence. No, real truth is silence. You know, when there's no words, when there's like the emptiness of a commentary. And that's the closest you can ever get to truth. It's in the emptiness of the mind, the silence of the mind. And it's only when that silence breaks into words that we get the conflict. And we get, Ajahn Chah used to say this. He said that when you take a cup of tea, it doesn't matter whether you're a Thai person or a Sri Lankan or an English or an Australian, the taste of the tea is the same. But we give it different names. The Thais call it cha. That's why, you know, that's a. This comes from the Chinese name for tea. That's why I always knew that before. That's when I heard about this monk called Ajahn Chah, and I liked tea so much. I thought this must be a great, my type of monk. The Thais call it cha. What is it? Someone else calls it tay and tea or whatever else it's called in this world. Doesn't matter what name you call it, it tastes the same. A lot of times that we're arguing over the names, not the meaning, nor what's behind it. And that's why it's wonderful actually to actually know sort of where all these arguments come from, where all these different ideas come from. It's just because of our different conditioning that we give things different names. Because of different names, we argue over these things. We don't need to argue over these things. You don't need to have conflict. Different cultures, different conditionings, different views, and from those views, different perceptions and thoughts. Where we think it's absolute truth, then that's where we go wrong. Now, one of the stories which I read a long time ago, which was really opened my eyes to how all this works, and just how much we can interpret the world because of our world views, and how even our just bare experience is already bent. It was actually coming from this book written by Dr. Moody, who was researching out-of-the-body experiences in this hospital in the US somewhere. It was a multicultural hospital in the sense that people from all sorts of different races and religions and genders were going into this hospital for their surgery, and some of them actually died on the operating table or were dead when they came in there but were revived. He gave everybody who had actually died in the hospital but were revived a questionnaire to see whether they had one or more of the out-of-body experiences. And most of the people did. Obviously, the questionnaire was done in confidence because he wanted to make sure that he wasn't, they weren't going to be afraid, because a lot of people have these experiences but don't like telling anybody because they think they'll be called crazy. And so it was given in confidence, and he published the results afterwards that most people had one or more of the classic experiences of floating out of the body, of going off to a light, going through the light, seeing someone at the other end, being told it's not your time, and then going back again into the body. It is classic out-of-the-body experiences which go across all cultures and all religions, which actually give it a sense of being, you know, quite truthful to reality. But one of the differences which he noticed, which when I read it I laughed because I understood what was going on. He said when a Christian, say when a Catholic, goes through the light, the person they meet at the other end is usually like the Virgin Mary or somebody. If it's a Jew, it was Moses they met. If it was like a Chinese Buddhist, it was the goddess of mercy, Kuan Yin. If it was a Hindu, it was a Lord Krishna. And if it was an atheist, it was Uncle George. And the fascinating thing about this was that when interviewing these people, they were absolutely sure they'd met Jesus, or they'd met Kuan Yin, or they'd met. It's interesting actually, Kuan Yin, this goddess of mercy. You know, the goddess of mercy, which many Chinese Buddhists have in their houses, that started off as a man. It started off as Avalokiteshvara in early Mahayana Buddhism in India. And the early statues were male. But when it sort of got to China, over the centuries, it changed into being a female. One of the first cases of sex change. But it only changed like that, really, because people wanted it to. Because they interpreted compassion as being more feminine than male. It's interesting just to see how things change like that. But this particular case, that whatever people see was very much what they expected to see. It was very clear that they added on to the experience much of what they expected to see when they died. And really, as far as I know, everyone saw the same thing when they died. But we added on those names, whether it was Jesus, Virgin Mary, Uncle George, or whatever. And I noticed that this is what we do with our experience. We add on so much to life that even our bare experience, what we see, what we hear, what we feel, so much has been added on. But we really think this is real, and we argue over that. It's because we each add on so much that our experiences of the world, of life, are so different. Who is the person you love the most in the world? Why do you love them? It was such a nice person, such a lovely person. If they were such a nice, lovely person, why doesn't everyone else love them? Who is the person you hate the most? The rottenest, meanest, nastiest person in the whole world. It's amazing, actually, to find the nastiest, meanest, rottenest person in the world, the one you hate the most, has got a husband and a wife and kids who adore them. Sometimes a great shock. How can anybody like that guy? But what it is it shows that we are adding so much on to reality. Because really, if they were really such a lovable person, then everyone would love them. If they were such a mean and nasty, rotten person, then wouldn't it be the case that everyone should hate them? So when you have your enemy, remember your enemy, there's lots of people who love them. And the person you love the most has lots of people who hate them. It's fascinating to look at things like that, which shows you that all this love and hate, we add on to the world. We add on to reality. When we understand that our likes and dislikes are added on, conditioned, it's quite easy to understand why we have arguments. You know, that even like arguments over food. What food is nice and what food is rotten when you go to a restaurant? Don't eat that, that's no good. Because I noticed that a lot of the things which are supposed to taste nice, so much of it is expectation and what's supposed to taste nice. Now, when I went to Thailand, some of the food which I ate in Thailand was absolutely disgusting. One day we had frog soup. When I talk about frog soup, it was literally just hot water with about a dozen frogs floating in it. You could see right to the bottom of the pot. And there was a little bit of salt in there, but nothing else. And the frogs were just big enough to put in your spoon and put in your mouth and go crunch. What'd you say yuck for? All of those who went, ugh, pull your hands up if you've ever ate frogs, whole frogs. See, none of you have, so why do you say it was yucky? That's what we call conditioning. You see, you don't even tasted it yet, and you already know it's rotten. You're adding on to what the reality, aren't you? That's what I was telling people in Armadale recently. Years and years ago, I had to go and teach Buddhism to a school, a primary school. And I didn't realize that the The years were year one and year two. When I went to the school, I thought, how on earth am I going to teach like Buddhism, like Four Noble Truths or dependent origination or emptiness to a group of 6 and 7 year olds? But I always like a challenge. And so how I dealt with teaching Buddhism and meditation to a group of year ones and years twos. I said, okay, kids, hands up if you don't like rice pudding. And about three or four kids put their hands up. They didn't like rice pudding. And then after 1 or 2 seconds, all the other kids were looking around, and a few other kids put their hands up as well. And then a few other kids. And then in about 5 seconds, a whole two classes had their hands put up. Yes, we don't like rice pudding. Rice pudding is yucky. Very good, very good. Now put your hands down. And of course, the second question was, now please put your hands up if you've ever eaten rice pudding. And only those three kids put their hands up. And all the other kids laughed. They understood a very deep part of Buddhism there. About conditioning. How much of our likes and dislikes are conditioned? Because other people say, frogs are yucky, then you think they are yucky when you never actually tasted frog soup in northeast Thailand. Actually, the strange thing was, all that really yucky food, which was yucky at first, after about 6 months, I started to enjoy it. That's what happens. After about 6 months of marriage to your husband, actually you quite like him. You sort of get used to people, don't you? That's the same with, it's called conditioning. So a lot of my likes and dislikes, my views of the world are very much conditioned. That's why even now, because I know this and realize that, even though I'm a Buddhist monk, and I spend most of my time with Buddhists, I make a point of keeping up correspondence with people who aren't Buddhists. Like even going to Christian churches and talking with somebody else. Because I know just how dangerous it would be to hang out with sort of, sycophants, Buddhists. Because I just hear what I want to hear. And I wouldn't have nothing to challenge me at all, nothing to widen my wisdom. So it's great sort of having other people around who challenge you, who ask you tough questions, who even aren't Buddhists at all. That's why I still keep up my friendship with my people I went to college with and school with, because especially because they're not Buddhists. Because I want to make sure that I'm not just conditioned into being a narrow-minded, fundamentalist, sort of one-pointed Buddhist monk. Neither should you be. That's why that when we widen our conditioning, we don't just stick to one thing, we're going to more likely have less arguments in the world. Because just like those two monks, instead of like arguing over one view, you can see a wider range of possibilities. You might actually be able to go to a farm and see chickens which actually do go quack quack, and then you realize you don't need to argue about it anymore. You realize you can be wrong. You realize that you don't need to argue about these things. So many of the conflicts in the world just come from misunderstandings when both people are right. There's this old story I read years ago about conflict resolution, about the two sisters who argued over an orange. There was only one orange in the kitchen, and both of them wanted it. They were arguing about who deserved it most. In the end, they could only come to a compromise, so they cut the orange in half. The first sister peeled the orange and threw the peel away and ate the orange. She wanted to eat an orange. And the second sister peeled the orange and threw the orange away because she needed to peel for a cake. If only they'd have talked to each other beforehand. One could have eaten the whole orange and one could have had twice as much peel for a cake. Isn't it the case that so often our arguments, if we could only realize what we both want, we could both be satisfied? And so often the conflicts we have in the world We should actually really look at more deeply, why are we arguing? Is it, do we really, can we really trust that we are right? Can we really know that our ideas, our views are absolute truths? And actually, if there is absolute truth, what is absolute truth? Absolute truth is silence, peace, harmony, kindness. If anything is absolute truth, surely that's absolute truth. Now, harmony, peace, the sort of love which, that way I describe love, the door of my heart is open to you no matter who you are, no matter what you do, no matter what you think. Even if you think totally different than me. Even if your ideas and my ideas are on the opposite end of the spectrum, you can still be my friend. That's what like loving kindness is. And isn't there a sense of like deep truthfulness in that? Something which transcends the mundane of my idea and my view. It's not that views are wrong. Everyone has to have a viewpoint. But when we realize where that viewpoint is coming from all our conditioning, from our training, from our schooling, from our upbringing, from our friends, from our peers, when we realize where it's coming from, we never trust that as being absolute. Never that strong that it's worthwhile having an argument and sacrificing our kindness. Why do you throw away love just to be right? We do that. Our family, our friends, our parents. We should know that that shows that we're wrong. This monk in Thailand once, he's been here a couple of times, there's two nuns in his monastery were arguing. Who was right and who was wrong? He said, if you're arguing, you're both wrong. Get out. He threw them out. Because both were wrong when there's an argument. There's a lot of truth behind that because we're missing the point. When we have arguments, we can have a debate, we can have a good discussion, an argument, but not sort of an argument for the sake of proving who's right and who's wrong. Now, there's a difference between debating and arguing, like you do sort of in your household sometimes. And sometimes that argument in the household is argument to death sometimes. I'm not going to give in, and the other person's not going to give in. That is fundamentalism. It's a jihad in your house. And where's that ever going to end? Because we have to live together. You know that I finish off with one of these stories. One of the people who was one of the first people who came to our monastery, still remember her because she came and stayed in a steel shed for a little while. She was married to a Canadian man and after he was here on some sort of contract, once his contract had finished, they had to go back to Canada. They had a marvelous idea. Instead of just selling their house and putting the money in the bank and getting a plane back to Toronto or something, they decided to sell their house and buy a yacht and sail that yacht back to Vancouver and sell the yacht in Vancouver. And with the money they got from their yacht, they could have the mortgage for the next house. They're a young couple. It's a lovely adventure. They're going sailing over the South Pacific somewhere, and the North Pacific. So they needed some help. They got another couple to help them, another Canadian man and wife. So there are four of them, two husbands and wives, set off sail from Perth all the way to Vancouver. And they wrote back later on about one of the experiences they had on the voyage, which is pertinent to this story or this talk this evening. She wrote that in the middle of the ocean, somewhere in the South Pacific, the yacht had engine trouble. They were becalmed. They were miles from anywhere, just in the middle of the ocean. And the two men, the only people who knew about the engine, had to go into the very small engine room to try and fix up the problem. The two women were on the deck, just reading newspapers, enjoying the sunshine. Not a magazine, sorry, not newspapers. Don't have newspapers deliveries in the middle of the ocean. Magazines, that's right. And it was hot. And it was difficult trying to fix this engine, which didn't want to be fixed in cramped quarters. And because it was hot and difficult and cramped, both of these men started getting irritated. And the irritation soon turned into an argument. And the argument soon turned into almost like a fight. They were shouting at each other, and one of the men got so mad with anger, he threw down his wrench and said, "Right, that's it, I'm leaving." And apparently this was actually true, what he did. He said, "Right, that's it, I'm leaving." He went to his cabin, he washed, he changed from his work clothes into his good clothes, his nice suit. He packed his suitcases, and he actually appeared on deck carrying his two suitcases. It was only when the women started laughing hysterically that he realized his predicament. There's ocean all around. There was nowhere to go. It's a wonderful story because he went red in the face, apparently, and turned around, went back to the cabin, unpacked the suitcases, changed back into his work clothes, and went back into the engine room to help out. A beautiful story. He did that because there was nowhere to go. Isn't it a wonderful story that even just how much we argue with each other, how much we have differences of opinion, how much we fight, look, there's nowhere to go, is there? You run away from your present partner. Where are you going to run to? Do you think you're really going to get some happiness somewhere else? And we sort of fight wars with different religions and different races. Look, this planet is just like that little yacht in the middle of the ocean. Where can we go to? Where can we run to? Look, there's nowhere to go. So why don't we just get back into the engine room and just work it out? When we realize that there's something more important than being right and being wrong. So more important than that. This is what spiritual paths are supposed to be pointing out. That which is more important, more sacred, more lofty than just all these differences of opinion, different memories, different ideas, different likes and dislikes. I like frog soup. I prefer pizza. Who cares? Let's go out and enjoy a nice meal together. Come to my monastery and have frog soup. Sometimes people say, "I thought you monks were vegetarian." I say, "I would have given anything to be a vegetarian when I was eating frog soup." But the point is that here we have the reason why we argue. If you've had that argument, if you've had that problem, please reflect upon it. What have you wasted? What have you sacrificed, just because you wanted to be right? Was it really worth it? What have you gained? And what have you lost? We may win the point, we may lose our marriage. We may, win the argument about being the best religion, but we destroy the world in the process. Why do we do that? We may prove to our friend that they were wrong and we were right. We have no friends anymore. What do you want in this world? What's really important? Really, it's just a matter of priorities and values. Being right and being wrong is low in the priorities, in the values. Having loving kindness, being able to say to everyone, "The door of my heart's open to you," no matter whether you're a Christian, a Buddhist, a Hindu, or Muslim, or non-believer, an atheist, or whatever, you can come in here and I'll be your friend. I can enjoy the difference which you bring to my experience. Thank you for being different. not the same. You can learn how to live together. So please, may we focus on the causes of conflict. May we understand why we have different ideas and views. May we understand what's more important in life. Focus on what's more important in life and stop having all these separations, all of these conflicts, all of these wars, all of the suffering which it entails, so we can live more happy, more at peace, more in harmony. So that's one of the reasons why I'm going to give a sermon at the cathedral in a week's time, and you're all welcome. So thank you this evening for listening to this talk.